Yeah, Michelle, we're good? Okay.
Hey there, Slavic Connection listeners. The episode you're about to hear was recorded in front of a live audience and is a part of our expert speaker series presented by Hashtag Connections.
Today, we're fortunate to have Dr. Taras Fedyirko of University of Glasgow, Scotland. Dr. Fedyirko is a political and economic anthropologist who focuses on political transformation in Ukraine post-2014 as a result of Euromaidan revolution. And currently, he's writing a book on post-Euromaidan journalism and the democratic change that it brought about.
It's not a typical Texas.
You're listening to the Slavic Connection, brought to you by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies and the William P. Clement Center for National Security at the University of Texas at Austin.
Dr. Fedyirko, very nice to have you in Austin.
Thank you, Misha. Thanks, everyone, for inviting me here.
So if you want to introduce your project briefly, please do so, so the audience can have a chance to know what it is.
Absolutely. It's good to be introducing it in the sense that it's a kind of a promise and then I had to keep. And I do need promises now because there is more than ever that's to be done in the political context that we have in the region. All other things that are sailing the book project, right? But as Misha said, I'm writing a book which is based on several years of fieldwork from 2017 onwards, which is trying to trace a transformation of the political, economic, and moral transformation of the journalistic profession in Kyiv, and is based on work with a group of people I call liberal reformists of the media profession, and who for some 25 years now, since the early 2000s have been and late 90s, have been involved in elite journalism and trying to transform censorship and various forms of political economic dependencies in the journalistic profession in Ukraine by first trying to organize a labor movement to transform the conditions of work. And when they failed to do that, increasingly under the influence of foreign Western democracy promotion and anti-disinformation grants, tried to train journalists to be proper selves, proper professionals individually and individually responsible for improper behavior, right? So, but that's a kind of a matryoshka-like project where journalism is the center, but as you are kind of trying to zoom out from that center, it is trying to tell a larger story about the transformation of civic elites post-Euromaidan, because I think that was a threshold moment, a result of prolonged process of transformation, but a moment nonetheless when a group of civic elites who had been pining for greater influence over the state finally obtained that and gained greater prominence that they then built upon, to the effect that today we're seeing that they've assumed much greater influence than before. And that's also where my next project comes in, that you're not talking about that today, but I'm continuing the sort of greater exploration, as you've indicated, of the post-Maidan transformations of statehood and the civic space in Ukraine.
So you've mentioned that basically the concept of liberty after liberalism. So liberalism, of course, comes as the result of collapse of the USSR. So could you please discuss whether and how the meaning of liberty in the context of media transformed in Ukraine after the collapse of the USSR, but also throughout those inflection points like the Orange Revolution and Euromaidan, and were they inflection points or the change was going to happen either way?
So what I'm trying to do with this idea of liberty, and it's liberty, not freedom, has several aspects to it. I mean, disciplinarily, I'm an anthropologist, and the topic of freedom and liberty has been quite important in the last maybe 10 years, 20 years in the discipline, specifically in the British corners of the wood where I've stalked, specifically anthropology of ethics and what has been trying to do to the discipline. Right. So there's that background. In the project, I am trying to explore how a peculiar conception of liberty, liberty as non-domination, as a negative freedom, but freedom from domination, has been at the center of the journalist project of opposing oligarchic domination, arbitrary power of the state over them. One thing I noticed in the field was when I worked at the field work at Hromadske TV and at Ukrainian Public Broadcaster Corporation, Suspilne, in 2017-18 primarily, was that when journalists talked about censorship, they first of all found it not a restriction of some sort of essentially free word, but an interference into their labor process. Censorship was annoying because it was someone, usually your colleague, messing with what you were doing. And that put me on track of trying to understand, you know, how journalists dealt with these journalists and their teachers had been dealing with various forms of control over their labor. Editorial control, but through editors by managers, owners, media owners. So in Ukraine, that means primarily large oligarchic groups and the state. And that led me to realize that at the core of this movement for the reform of the journalistic profession was an idea of liberty as freedom from domination and not an idea of free speech as freedom from government or some other interference. That was also mm-hmm. present. But most important was this, what you would call Republican, following mm-hmm. Philip Pettit, or if you're into Quentin Skinner, a neo-Roman idea of liberty. Mm-hmm. In Ukraine, there's, of course, an idea that might have come. I'm not an historian of political thought, so I know there's some historians here, so you might want to correct me, but you can trace the legacy or the genealogy of that idea to multiple sources. It could go as far as Polish republicanism in the 16th century and the Cossack ideas of republican freedom taken up through mm-hmm. different points up to the Maidan with the Cossack myth. It could be a socialist idea of wage labor as wage slavery, for example. Mm-hmm. It could be other ideas, right? But what I found interesting was, and why it's liberty after liberalism, besides a kind of a fictitious twist on Skinner's liberty before liberalism, is that in the 1990s, the liberalization, sort of the great experiment of transforming the world through liberal democracy and liberal markets that came mm-hmm. into the second world, that experiment let loose all kinds of forces in Ukraine that led to the emergence of somewhat free markets, but also rise of the oligarchs who ended up buying up most of the media organizations in the country and exercised a particular form of control in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And in response to that, there was an uptake of an idea of liberty as resistance to, as absence of arbitrary power, arbitrary authority and domination, right? So hence mm-hmm. liberty, republican liberty as a response to the conditions of, if you will, market freedoms, liberty after liberalism. And to finish, that idea transformed because the conditions for exercising it were always subpar, even among the elite Ukrainian journalists. And so part of my interest is in tracing how that notion and the struggle for emancipation of the journalistic profession led the initial labor movement to kind of transform into an almost moralized project of reforming journalists rather than the profession as a whole.
If they were trying to freeze themselves from the oligarchs and the people who were controlling the media, that means that the Ukrainian government was not kind of infringing on their freedom of speech, as you kind of imply. So does that mean that the government could control the media through oligarchs, though, at specific moments during Kuchma's presidency, for instance?
Well, Kuchma's presidency were different from one another. I mean, we're talking about
1994 to 2004.
Well, yes, true. Thanks. I was about to say something stupid because I was thinking about the second Kuchma presidency from late 98, right? Mm-hmm. 99. And the two presidencies were different from each other, right? So the first one was the period of emergent oligarchy mm-hmm. and still emergence of a system of what you could call paternal control, where Kuchma was the patron in chief, mediating between different competing patron-client pyramids. And by the second presidency, that control was consolidated enough and that arbitrating position was powerful enough to allow Kuchma then to kind of move away from the direct use of state power to police mm-hmm. Speech, media speech, although there was one big exception, the murder of Georgi Gongadze and some other cases, and go to negotiating with media owners. Complicating factor there was that up until the late 1990s, there was indeed a semblance of almost a free media market in the country where lots of foreign investors had purchased broadcasting licenses, often many of them from the US, but not just. And by the late 1990s, they, under state pressure and under kind of commercial pressure from Russian capital and to a lesser extent Ukrainian capital, began to sell off those assets. And so you need for Kuchma to start to outsource control, or for anyone, to any post-Soviet presidency, to outsource central control over media to media owners, you need those media owners to be pliable, right? Mm-hmm. And that often means that they would have to be local media owners, or at least post-Soviet media owners, as opposed to foreign capital, mm-hmm. because that could resist by using influence through U.S. embassy or other embassies. So this, what I'm trying to say, there were several shifts throughout the late 90s that led to a transformation of this landscape of state influence over the media, where the media owners became an important mediating point.
Is Ukraine's case different, though, from, for example, Russia's case, where its oligarchs also controlled large swaths of media, and how a media could exist after socialism, after collapse of the USSR? Was there any viable way for media to make money and exist without having patronage?
Yes, the Ukrainian case is similar to the Russian case in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And of course, the situation with media in Russia begins to change with the arrival of Vladimir Putin to the Kremlin, and with the process of centralization, federal centralization of power over oligarchs that he begins, right? Mm-hmm. The Ukrainian political system is often compared, the Ukrainian political system over the 30 years since the fall of the Soviet Union is compared to the Russian political system under President Yeltsin, mm-hmm. right? As a kind of a competitive authoritarianism or a number of relatively autonomous patron-client pyramids competing for power over the presidency. And that changes in Russia because it becomes a one patron, chief patron mm-hmm. system where Putin subjugates it, right? So that changes the matters. But for a good part of the 90s and in the elite corners of the profession in Russia up until very recently, I think there was a possibility, a greater possibility than in Ukraine, because Russia is a vastly more resourced mm-hmm. country and richer in many respects than Ukraine, to maintain a viable commercial media that doesn't rely on patronage. That said, in both countries, there have been cases of limited patronage through a practice known as jinsa, so a kind of a payola like arrangement, wherein one news beat is sold mm-hmm. to willing buyers. So, for example, economic news are sold to companies as hidden advertisement, but the political news remains properly independent from that point of view, right? So where jinsa in one sector cross-subsidizes proper reporting, quote-unquote, in another sector. Mm-hmm. So there were multiple arrangements, which I think, and they've changed through time, which I think shows that journalists and editors were trying to find a way of eking out a decent professional space for themselves, mm-hmm. where they could respect themselves as makers of and writers of news, vis-a-vis ideals of professionalism, whether they were still late Soviet ideas of professionalism or quote-unquote liberal model, Anglo-Saxon, imported BBC standards, and so on. Mm-hmm.
And when did Ukraine start developing independent media? Would you consider the oligarch-controlled media to be independent, free, or how would you qualify it?
Well, luckily I'm an anthropologist and I can just outsource that to my interlocutors. In terms of the notion of independence, you start seeing it in late perestroika, right? This idea that, and that's part of the inspiration for the domination by the party of newspapers and broadcasters in Ukraine and in Russia. It's partly an inspiration for the language of autonomy, of editorial autonomy, which is squarely a republican language of independence, right? And the hierarchical language, independence from top-down control. You see, for example, I found a wonderful quote in a book by A.A. Chichanovsky, published in 1989 in Kyiv, which is a series of his reflections about being an instructor in the higher party school in Moscow. So basically a person who trains editors in being not just editors, but also censors for the party, where he says that, unfortunately, and I'm quoting from memory, journalists and editors have taken perestroika as an occasion for complete autonomy. And complete autonomy for him is a swear word. Right. So you start seeing this ideal already then. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, I think there was Ilya Yablokov, for example, wrote wonderfully about this. I guess it was Elizabeth Schimfassel, about this golden period in Russia, for two, 3 years in the early 90s, still under Soviet rule and immediately after, where there was still state funding. There was already market ad revenue and no longer party control, which was a kind of this almost libertarian mm-hmm. moment. And then things started to change. I don't think that, and to your question on whether or not the oligarch-owned media are independent, that changes, and it depends on who is responding. I refuse to respond because I leave it up to my interlocutors. And of course, for all of them, whether they are in the so-called independent media or in the oligarch-owned media, commercial media, as they would be called, otherwise mainstream media, they all see some form of autonomy as desirable. You know, I had these interesting conversations with people who I knew for a fact, and they admitted that they were engaged in various forms of sort of censorial news production, producing news on behalf of or to promote the interest of the media owner, where still they would boast of doing that out of their own will and doing that well and autonomously without commands from above. So you see there too a certain ideal of independence in practice.
And when you say independent media, you imply that they were funded by Western grants, by Western embassies, or maybe Western tycoons or something like that. Would you say that that is true independence? Did those kind of financial injections give enough autonomy to Ukrainian media to operate without restrictions?
I think we can invert that question and ask about the forms of dependence. It's a question that troubles me, and it's something that I often get asked. And of course, it's something that's available both as a source of irony, a source of critique within the media profession, right? So the critics of the Nezalezhny media, independent media in Ukraine, would say, oh, you're not independent, you're grant eaters, rantoyide, right? And they would themselves call themselves grant eaters sometimes for fun. The question, acknowledging that they labored under a kind of domination which was impersonal. It was a domination by impersonal structures of foreign grants and grant projects. And anyone who's worked on a grant, maybe in the university, will know what I'm talking about, which was annoying for them, often led to various forms of shortfalls of funding when grants wouldn't come through on time, leading to informal practices within newsrooms. So basically suboptimal in many respects. But compared to personal and unchecked arbitrary domination by media managers who claim to represent interests of the owner and could take down your news spot because it mentioned the wrong person, that was still much, much preferred, right? So We can talk about different forms of domination, how they work. Personal domination versus impersonal domination, domination that could be still claimed to result in production of news for broad public interest versus production of news for a particular political clique, in the case with commercial oligarchical media, and so on and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. So the question of independence was a very contested one, but still there were meaningful differences between forms of dependence, kind of enough to motivate journalists to sort out and into different camps.
And having read part of your monograph, I know that you say independent media did not have the same resources that the oligarch-controlled media had. Of course, majority of the people were watching or reading oligarch-controlled media, but was there kind of like a willingness on the part of Ukrainian society to read those more Western-leaning publications or watch their programs before it became mainstream? And of course, you know, when the oligarch order was kind of disrupted after this full-scale invasion, but was there a niche in Ukrainian society for this kind of journalism?
Of course there was. The question was, how large was it? Mm-hmm. And how willing were the producers of these kinds of news to enlarge it? They, as you mentioned, I mean, they did not have even a fraction of the resources that the mainstream media had, or a fraction of the audiences or the recognition. Romadske TV, which for maybe 8 years after, well, 7 years after the Maidan, so post-2013, were hailed as this sort of the poster child of this reform movement and of independent media, the audience was very small. I mean, if they got 40,000 views or 40,000 reads on an article, that was good. I remember an audience study that they did, which was done partly for the attention of their funders, where they emphasized that, yes, the audience was small, but it was large online, on the website and on YouTube, but it was large on Facebook, which meant a very particular middle-class bias immediately, because Facebook functions as a sort of middle-class agora in Ukraine. And it was large among, or relatively large among, better-educated, more urban, more male, middle-aged people, which again suggests targeting of a particular stratum, right? So they were proud that the decision makers would read them, and they had influence among decision makers as opposed to lay people. And a good demonstration of that was early on, I think in 2017, when I was in the field, and Ukraine had to implement another set of adjustments in response to critique and a new packet of support from the International Monetary Fund, which required an almost trebling of, or doubling of, I can't remember exactly, and don't trust anthropologists in numbers anyway, but almost doubling of gas prices for consumers. And Hromadske supported that, saying, we need to do that because IMF is trying to de-oligarchize Ukraine. And you, reader, should understand that paying double for your gas consumption for your heating is good for you. And I found that baffling. And still, that I think that was telling as a moment of that revealed their solidarity as an organization.
Would you say it was the chicken or the egg moment where Ukrainian meat, because everybody in the West says Ukrainian people have this kind of freedom or liberty gene running through them, or DNA, stuff like that. So would you say media played any role in that perception?
Should we even go there? No. I think we should all read the new book that's come out under Andreas Uhlmann's editorship called The Ukrainian Mentality, because we will find out everything about, it's a joke, by the way, find everything we need to know about the Ukrainian genes. But Ukrainian media, you know, I don't know how influential or in what way the influence of this media was. I'd say that it was influential among the people who were naturally leaning or naturally socially leaning to that particular project that they were promoting. So again, as I said, more male, more better educated, more Western orientated, because the media functioned in that circle to build up a certain forms of political solidarity, I think, around, you know, this sort of, and it helps support the Euro-Atlanticist turn post-Maidan. And that's, you know, Hromadske, BBC, Radio Europe, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and a number of other new outlets. They all worked to consolidate a certain vision of these Europeanist reforms post-Maidan. Mm-hmm. And as such, it's a project that has become influential through the people whom that project launched into government successively, through sort of civic opposition to corruption or what is called corruption or oligarchization, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it was not a project that became important by disseminating ideas broadly to the rest of the population. Mm-hmm. I'm not a great believer in dissemination of ideas anyway, mm-hmm. which is ironic, I think, for an educator. But I tend to see that these media as part of an almost class project of building a particular project of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a historic block, if you will, if you're inclined to speak in the Gramscian language.
Mm-hmm. And I want to return back to the Orange Revolution era, because I think it was pivotal in many respects when Ukraine had this competitive authoritarianism, as you said, mm-hmm. and Russia also had that during Yeltsin, I would argue. And then, of course, everything shifted, but everything could also be different in Ukraine. And as you have kind of imply, it's a top-down transformation in Ukraine, not bottom-up. Would you say that Orange Revolution was precipitated by independent media or by competing interests within oligarch-controlled media? What role did media play in that revolution?
So the journalists like to remember Orange Revolution as a moment of their own importance. And that's not surprising. I think that's just very human. There is some truth to that, and not many probably remember that about a month or a month and a half before the start of the protests in Maidan in November, 22nd of November 2004, but a month and a half before, there was a so-called journalist revolution where workers at one TV channel, which was suffering from top-down repression by Kuchma, I think that was Piaty Kanal, channel number 5, which maybe, oh, my God, Steven, maybe you'll help me, maybe was already owned by Petro Poroshenko by that point, I think it was. They launched a hunger strike, and then they were supported later on by news hosts and journalists from other organizations, including the largest at the time, One Plus One TV mm-hmm. channel. By that point, still part owned by an American owner and philanthropist. And that, people claim, helped precipitate the Orange Revolution. Mm-hmm. Certainly, at one point early on, the turn of many of these journalists to disobey the Temnike censorship, the so-called themes or topics system of censorship, where the presidential administration would send out specific topics for the day or for the week and how they had to be covered. The turnaround against that and the start of covering of the protest, it helped support the protest. And I think that was kind of an amplifying influence, right? Because the media function is part of the infrastructure of supporting the civic mobilization, political mm-hmm. mobilization. I wouldn't say that the media caused, right, the protest. And from then on, I think you could say, countering this, that key people from this reform movement, from this sector of the journalistic profession, played important roles, political roles, in subsequent events of contention and politically, right? Many of them went into parliament. Some of them became ambassadors in the 2004 Yushchenko administration, and then later on post Euromaidan as well, right? So there was a movement from journalism into politics, which happened for all factions, politically speaking, of journalists. But I think it was influential for these sort of Europe-orientated liberal journalists. But that was not, it had, I'm not sure what it had to do with the influence of the media as a sector, if you understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. So specific individuals, but not maybe the media.
And you've mentioned the Temniki, or, you know, the directions from the government, broadly speaking, to the media on what to report on and how. And in that context, we can't not talk about Viktor Medvedchuk, who comes up in your monograph later on and becomes a significant character of the full-scale invasion and the period leading up to it. What was his role in kind of this Orange Revolution era and before that?
I like this. You know, we are engaged in a kind of a prefigurative monograph writing. So the more we talk about it, the more real it becomes. Medvedchuk is absolutely central for me, and also for the project that I'm doing, but also for journalists. He comes up to play an important role more recently, and I hope we'll talk about that. But in the early 2000s, he was, besides having served as the chairperson, I think, of the Social Democratic Party United, SDPUA, he became the head of the presidential administration. So something like a vice president, I think, of Leonid Kuchma's. And as such, became a very important person in orchestrating the system of censorship, Temnike censorship. Temnike was not Medvedchuk's invention. And you'll recognize the Greek origins of the word, tema, right? So theme. Temnike was an import from Russia. The gallerist Marat Gilman claims to have invented Temnike, because he moonlighted as a political consultant, a political technologist, as the role is known as in Eastern Europe. And it was tried out in Ukraine, first within Medvedchuk-controlled or his party-controlled media, which was the third largest national channel, Inter, part Ukraine-owned, part owned by the first channel in Russia, and controlled by Medvedchuk's party. And then from late 90s, I think, Inter was this sort of kind of a lab for Temnike censorship. And from 2002, that was rolled out under Medvedchuk's administration, in the presidential administration, was rolled out to all of Ukrainian national broadcasters. And so Medvedchuk was much hated in the profession for that, right? My memory fails to kind of point to other points of contention between the profession and Medvedchuk at the time, but I think that was his major role. And of course, the Temniki became this kind of galvanizing point for the protests among journalists and for resignations from 1+1 and from other channels in the run up to the Orange Revolution. Mm-hmm. So it embodied the government control. Right? And besides just being control, it offended the sensibilities of journalists, because they were told what to say. And I think many of us who believe maybe that academic work is also a vocation, not just professional work, not just something that can be necessarily controlled. Something that, if you believe that academic work, and by extension maybe many other forms of professional work, requires autonomy, then we can recognize that being told what to do in quite that way, being told what to say, if your vocation is to be creative in what you say, and the act of creation is, you know, developing a particular kind of narrative, et cetera, is profoundly offensive. Not just politically, but also morally, mm-hmm. right? So what I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to get across the stakes of that resistance to that form of censorship, right? Mm-hmm. So that I don't just sound like someone who's promoting this idea that it was all purely for some high ideals of freedom of speech. I think it was deeply personally felt at almost a material level, at the level of what makes you as a person if you work in that profession.
You've already kind of touched on the Yushchenko's presidency, and that journalists have started playing a more prominent role in the political sphere. But Verze keeping Yushchenko and his government politically accountable during that period? And was there any censorship on the part of the government towards them?
I think that period was, we're talking about 2004 to 2010. That period was, it's not remembered for great attempts by the government to influence Ukrainian media and broadcasters. Mm-hmm. But there was another form of influence on editorial agendas and control of editorial agendas that developed, and it was connected to this practice which I've called Jinsa, which people call Jinsa, which I've mentioned already. So private buyers effectively purchasing media coverage that is then masqueraded as legitimate news. And to make sense of this, I have to kind of step back and explain that, go back to the way in which President Kuchma, the previous president, had run his administration. I mentioned that he was the arbiter in between multiple groups. And as he was about to step down and to pass the reins to his next president, which could be either Yushchenko or Viktor Yanukovych, which was the whole point of kind of the contestation around the Orange Revolution, I think Kuchma was very worried that whoever came next would inherit this centralized government machine which Kuchma had built to serve his interest, and would use that to hit Kuchma-affiliated oligarchs, among whom was Kuchma's son-in-law, Viktor Pinchuk, the great philanthropist, / oligarch. I hope he doesn't get offended when he gets called oligarch. I mean, he's the person who now, as you will well know, sponsors the Ukraine breakfast at the Davos Forum. He supports the YES Forum, Yalta Forum, Yalta European Strategy Forum in Kyiv, and so forth. Back then, he was unquestionably an oligarch who had just acquired the first large media holding in the country. And so to mitigate potential fallout from the new presidency, Kuchma and the ruling party of power, as it was called, instigated a constitutional reform in the country, which meant that the center of political gravity moved from the presidency to the parliament. The new president, Yushchenko, was much weakened, and he could not control a very divided legislature. And so instead of trying to appease the president and get the president's opinion on mediating conflicting interests, these rising oligarchs who were getting richer by the day, I mean, this is the peak point in privatization of iron smelters and heavy industry in Ukraine, and a peak point in a global commodity super cycle with very high iron, coal, and oil and other prices, meaning that these oligarchs who were controlling heavy industries were making a killing on privatization, buying up media assets. Instead of going to the president, these oligarchs began increasingly to turn to the parliament and buy up political parties. They bought up media and used media as a bargaining chip with political parties in the parliament. And the lesser ones who didn't quite have, $100 million to purchase a TV channel and a license and to support sleek media production to attract viewers and so on and so forth, channels at the time could boast a 25% share of audience. It was massive. I mean, it's something unheard of here. And also the quality of production was something that had nothing to do, was completely divorced from the levels of revenue at the time. Ukrainian television was always, because of this oligarchic cross-subsidization, was incredibly sleek and well-produced. So those who didn't have the money to do that started to purchase just a place in the evening news, $2,000 on a local Kyiv channel for a 15-minute appearance on a Friday night. All right, I mean, it's not too expensive. I mean, you could afford that. Or $150 for a favorable article in Zerkalo Tyzhnya, a reputable newspaper. Zerkalo Tyzhnya, maybe $300, right? And that led to this new sense of moral crisis in the profession. Censorship was no longer centralized. It was diffuse. It was something that was, because of that, a lot harder to fight. And that led the reformers, who were now better funded because suddenly Ukraine was a democracy in the eyes of the State Department, in the eyes of the Swedish International Development Agency, in the eyes of the Foreign Office in the UK. They started giving money for democracy promotion to consolidate the gains. And the media reform movement, which at that point was just a bunch of trade unions and a media organization, began to expand. And they expanded around projects for combating Jinsa, the journalistic corruption. And they chose to combat it. They called it censorship by money. And because it was decentralized, they chose to combat it by journalistic trainings, which also fit really nicely into the log frames of development projects. they were quantifiable. You could report that maybe social change wasn't achieved, but 1,500 journalists went through the training, which of course meant that 1,500, you know, gained better skills at doing what they had been doing before, and they returned back to their newsrooms and kept doing what they were doing, just they were better at that. And that in turn, over time, led to a frustration in the reform movement that their attempts at reform are not successful at all, right? They were failing at what they were trying to do. Sorry, I've given you this sort of slightly big picture.
No, it's fantastic. And, you know, kind of to, if they failed to do what they were, I don't know, intending to do, President Yanukovych comes to power in 2010, and he is widely considered to be pro-Russian president. Did this sort of independent media and Western-trained journalists, what was their attitude towards President Yanukovych before he was elected, kind of briefly, and then when he was elected during his time in power?
So until 2013, when we talk about independent media, we're talking about a couple of newsrooms with direct foreign funding, that's BBC Ukrainian and Radio Free Europe. And from 2008 onwards, several program teams, investigative program teams, for example, that were based at larger organizations, but sometimes were oligarch-controlled. So they were not completely separate. And what happens under Yanukovych is an increased oligarchic competition against this new they were called mlado oligarche, the young oligarchs that are raised from nowhere by Yanukovych, right? Because Yanukovych tries to, he sets up policies that favor his son and several other cronies that become these new oligarchs that start to try to buy up media. Up until 2013, there had been also some commercial media with Western licenses. So, for example, Forbes Ukraine, that despite the financial crisis in 2008-09, had managed to eke out some form of existence for themselves, partly catering to the interests of the growing Ukrainian economy. Under Yanukovych, the economic growth slows down. Post-crisis recovery slows down. There's this greater competition for what essentially is a shrinking pie of resources. And the media use it to some extent to their advantage because they're positioned as agents within a field of competition, and that actually allows them some degree of autonomy. But that kind of ends when from late 2010 and onwards, and increasingly in like 2012 and 2013, actors close to Yanukovych begin to prep for the future elections in 2015 that never came in that form, because Yanukovych he fled after the revolution in 2014. They start preparing by buying up media and by instituting forms of control, which then journalists found is ingenious. We have this famous case of one of the cronies of Yanukovych's son buying from Petro Poroshenko's media holding Forbes Ukraine, buying Korrespondent, which was another important independent, commercially oriented sort of quality newspaper. I think they're better recognizable as quality papers and quality journalism than as independent per se. So journalists feel a squeeze, and many of them join this group of about 100 called Stop Censorship, that later, from 2013 onwards, becomes the group that launches Hromadske TV, Hromadske Radio, and a number of other organizations, right? So there is this sort of coalition building among a very small portion of journalists who are better connected, who are more internationalized, who often have foreign degrees, and who have a lot to lose.
Did journalism play a role in kind of instigating and fueling, to some extent, maybe Euromaidan revolution? Was their role more pronounced than during the Orange Revolution?
I'm not sure about them being more pronounced. Mm-hmm. I'm a little biased because I don't remember the Orange Revolution that well, and I have not seen sources that would indicate the degree of influence, right? Mm-hmm. And I was a sympathizer of the events in 2014, which I think limited my ability to observe dispassionately what was going on. But by 2014, there are several kind of technical possibilities that enable the would-be independent media to emerge. And that's the spread of the internet, higher speed broadband, YouTube, direct broadcasting into YouTube, broadcasting from the spot with, you know, an iPad and a SIM card, which allowed multiple new organizations to basically come together in amid the protests. Baromaiske was launched, well, a couple of days after. I mean, they'd been gearing up to it, but they were launched a couple of days after the beginning of the protests, and basically hit the ground running, broadcasting what was going on in the absence of sympathetic or even partial broadcasting and coverage, news coverage, of the protests from oligarch-affiliated or state-owned media, right? So they played a role of, again, of amplifying the protests. I'm not sure whether that amplification was of qualitatively different scale than in 2005, but it did play a big role. And it's remembered as such by actors on the ground, both journalists and participants of the event. Of course, also there's this myth that the protests were started by Mustafa Nayem, who launched the journalist from Ukrainska Pravda, had been at Ukrainska Pravda, was then a member of this sort of Stop Cenzuri affiliated group, and was at Hromadske at the time, who wrote on Facebook, come out to protest the fall of the EU association agreement and government's refusal to sign the EU association agreement, which was the galvanizing point for the protests on 21st of November, I think 21st, 2013. So there was a journalist in the middle of it all. Mm-hmm. There were several other people from the movement, such as Victoria Sumar, who was at the time head of a key organization setting professional standards called Institute for Mass Information, who later became one of the members of the governing council or coordinating council of the Maidan, to the extent that it had a coordinating council. And Sumar later had a political career affiliated with People's Front and Turchinov and the right, and is still in the parliament. So there were journalists who played roles as kind of nodes in this network of the civic protest, I think. Mm-hmm. Not through their reporting, perhaps, but through the kinds of resources they had access to and the connections. So those are the two aspects.
Yes, and to rewind the time a little bit, it seems like after 2014 war in Donbass and, you know, kind of like the eventual freezing of the conflict, the oligarchs took a hit, especially those based in eastern Ukraine, Donbass, you know, the richest man in Ukraine, Rinat Akhmetov, lost probably a third of his holdings and assets. It was becoming harder for them to finance media, and of course the whole unstable situation was having an effect as well. You know, and then we eventually come to President Zelensky, who was also elevated by media to some extent to his presidency in 2019. Could you describe their role in kind of bringing him up to power?
Right. Those of you who watched the presidential campaign in Ukraine might remember that on the eve of the elections, on the New Year's Eve of 2019, OnePlus One, the largest channel by audience share, maybe budgets as well, in Ukraine, owned by Ihor Kolomoisky, well, owned by a bunch of offshore entities, about 100 of them, I think, but ultimately by Ihor Kolomoisky. Instead of broadcasting incumbent President Poroshenko's speech on the New Year's Eve, broadcast Volodymyr Zelensky's speech, which was unheard of, right? And then they showed, on repeat, they showed Poroshenko. Kolomoisky was one of the investors and longtime supporters of Zelensky's rather successful media business, the comedy media business, right? Comedy production studio. They hosted his program, OnePlus One, and gave lots of money. So the speculations around oligarch support for Zelensky are based on that kind of commercial relationship, which potentially went beyond a commercial relationship. And it's often described as, you know, Kolomoisky's attempt at vengeance against Poroshenko for what Poroshenko's administration had privatized on IMF's suggestion. The rather corruptly run largest private bank in Ukraine, Privatbank, owned by Kolomoisky and his partners. But all of that sort of fades, and the significance of that fades, not just because of the full-scale invasion, which has changed things dramatically, but also because of the quick turn of Zelensky's against and other oligarchs. Zelensky's administration was distinguished compared to Poroshenko and previous administrations by the fact that he was rather resource poor. He was not a billionaire or even a modest millionaire, not a billionaire. He did not have a long-standing stable alliance with a particular group of backers among the oligarchs. He is backed by millionaires who are trying to build up a new kind of a neoliberal rules of the game and a new game, but that's a different matter. He did not have a media organization of his own, or a party that would have people with media ownership. The party was built around the president's brand, making party members extremely dependent on the president, whether they were party list MPs or members of parliament or first past the post, majoritarian system MPs. And that was just very strange for Ukraine, right? So when Zelensky saw that his promise of de-oligarchization and anti-corruption was starting to fade in the eyes of the electorate, by the end of his first or mid-second year of his rule, seeing that Medvedchuk's party, opposition platform for life, was rapidly gaining ground, Servant of the People, the president's party, was losing ground, he decided to hit at the oligarchs. And that, of course, led to an immediate turnaround in media coverage of the presidency. Up until then, I think there was some attempt by all of the four or five major oligarchic groups, except for Poroshenko, to use their media assets to build up a report to the presidential administration to support it. We don't know whether that was a part of a quid pro quo deal or simply an opening gesture in inviting reciprocity, as had happened before Poroshenko. But that changes. And that changes, and it becomes kind of comes to quite dramatic consequences when at regional elections in four regions in, I can't remember, late 2020, early 2021, the opposition platform for life comes first, right? The president's party drops down in the ratings very, very drastically. So we see that lack of resource play out. In response, Zelensky tries to put a lot of money into a new TV channel called Rada, which used to be a parliamentary news TV channel. He supports the transformation of the public broadcaster as a non-state entity, doesn't touch that, Poroshenko had. Starts up a new channel, which is more government-controlled, and also another one called Dom for Russian language broadcasting in the occupied territory. So there is some investment in the media, because I think the administration realizes that they need that resource, because it's important for, you know, if you will, manufacturing consent, but it's also important as a tool of influencing the elites. Because that's one of the roles that these privately owned media and state-owned media played all the way through Ukraine's independence, not just as a tool of influencing the voters, but also as an instrument of intra-elite signaling. And that's kind of where Zelensky meets the war, or the war meets Zelensky. I mean, by that point, that there was a meeting among the oligarch-supported groups to set up a new party to challenge Zelensky, etc., etc. So he was in deep trouble as of January 2022.
In your monograph, you also discuss that, of course, Zelensky eventually banned the three opposition channels, you know, which were owned by Viktor Medvedchuk, and that you kind of imply that precipitated, to some extent, the war, maybe the intervention eventually by Russia, that the Russians felt like their influence was waning and they felt threatened. And that's the argument that many people make, I think, as well. Do you think that Russia had a plan for kind of penetrating Ukrainian media landscape and influencing Ukraine from within through this fourth power, so to speak?
You know, it's there's several caveats I'd like to make there, but let me work through this. It's easy to study Western influence on Ukraine and on Ukrainian media because a lot of that is out in the open. It's in the State Department documents. It's on USAID library. It's in the SIDA or FCDO public documentation. You can quantify it. You can name specific people responsible for these programs. And you can understand the way in which democracy promotion works through the media. It's a lot more murky with Russian influence in Ukraine. I've had to kind of travel a certain journey myself to stop simply resisting this idea, because the evidence that I'd been seeing was very, you know, there was none or very little evidence, or evidence came from the security services, to come and realize that part of that evidence was correct. And then with time, investigative journalism revealed a lot of actually what explained the way in which Russian states connected money entered Ukraine and supported certain production of certain media narratives, right? So with Medvedchuk, what happens is that he comes back to political prominence in 2014 as this person flying between Kyiv and the Kremlin, in an intermediary between Bankov, the Kremlin, and the separatists. And that allows him then to make a claim, I think, to the Kremlin that he's useful again. He has a sort of fictive kinship connection to Putin, but that's not that important. I think what's important is that he's a sort of an opportunistic entrepreneur who's trying to make space for himself. And he makes space by claiming that he has some influence, and he is given a share in a lucrative, literally given a share for $30 million in a business that, or 15, I can't remember anthropologist numbers, no. But a share in a business owned by someone else, a share that would have cost hundreds of million dollars, an oil transportation business from Rostov. He's given a couple of tankers to transport oil, and he uses that, the profits from that, to support the party, Opposition Platform for Life, in which he comes up to, I mean, he kind of stages kind of a takeover of the party, really, because he was no one in the party at that point. And to buy out the three TV channels from different figures affiliated with the party. We're talking about Zeek, 112, and News One, which were all always sort of Eastern Slavic, pro-Russian vaguely. You could never say whether that was directly promoting a particular agenda that came from the Kremlin or simply playing with the electorate receptive to those ideas, you know? And I find it difficult to say. But from maybe 2019, when Medvedchuk buys out these channels, you can say for certain that there is money coming from Russia and also from his, Medvedchuk's, trade in diesel with the separatists, right? So, and that's a successful business funding model, a media funding model, right? Cross-subsidization. And that is used to promote programs called, for example, It Stinks of Soros, which criticize grant eaters. I mean, it's straight out of the Hungarian propaganda playbook. It is used to promote peace in peace agreement, Minsk peace agreements that's very unfavorable for Kyiv in Donbass, to criticize the government, criticize Euro-Atlantic integration. But also, it is full, I mean, you have to understand, these channels are full of Ukrainian nationalists who are also doing everything that everyone else was doing at the same time. And I have this wonderful interview with someone who sadly died in the war, who was an analyst at all of these TV channels, who was a Marxist, a translator of Marko Boytsun's book into Ukrainian, and a really wonderful person who observed the transformation that happened under Medvedchuk, yet kept doing what he was doing, advising the channels on the kind of propaganda they were doing. And he said that, look, privately, most of the people working here believe that, you know, do not believe the propaganda. They are all for Euro-Atlantic integration. But the pay was almost double or triple what it was at other TV channels, certainly what it was at the independent TV channels, right? So there is a sort of transformation that has a professional dimension, it has a geopolitical dimension, and that I've come to appreciate does kind of show one way of influencing, right? And Opposition Platform and Medvedchuk might have worked, and we don't know because this otherwise the evidence is scant. And I hope that I'll be proven wrong, and there will be some open evidence, except for the leaks from the Ukrainian security services, about the ways in which they were negotiating with the Kremlin about what narratives and what political positions to promote. But from the point of view of the Kremlin, I think it's fair to say that whatever the direct connection between the party and Medvedchuk was and the Kremlin, the kind of political agendas they were promoting were opportune for, were good for the Kremlin's vision of Ukraine. Russia had for several decades, by that point, tried to support political forces in Ukraine, rhetorically or financially. Financially, I don't know, but rhetorically, certainly, political forces in Ukraine that promoted a vision of a not anti-Russian Ukraine. Paul Danieri has written in the new edition of his book rather brilliantly about it, tracing these forms of influence over 30 years. And it was so with the Opposition Platform for Life. And when the President Zelensky sanctioned media, the owner of these channels, Taras Kozak, who was a close ally with Viktor Medvedchuk, and when Medvedchuk was accused of high treason and terrorism finance later on, that in a sense was a major hit to party finance because of these murky forms of finance to the party. It was a major hit to the party's influence joint over voters. And as such, it undermined the almost last remaining systemic political pillar, a political force that could have kept Ukraine more or less in the Kremlin's orbit. whether or not there was any direction from the Kremlin. Again, I mean, I leave that for others to decide. And why is that? It is because Russia had instigated the war in Donbass and took over Crimea that lost 2.5 million voters, which would have been pro-Russian voters. It was the stupidest thing to do, right? It was their own doing. But by sanctioning these TV channels and the assets, which was important, it wasn't just the TV channels, there was the kind of the collapse of that last political force, which logically would have led the Kremlin to say, okay, what are the options now? And a month after the sanctions happened on the 3rd of February, 2021, a month after, or month and a half, Russia starts to build up a military force on the border with Ukraine in ostensibly for military exercises and never, it prepositions forces, prepositions equipment that it never takes away and is used in the 2022 invasion. I'm not saying that that was the moment when the invasion, the decision had been taken or anything. We don't know for sure. There's signs to say that maybe that was the case, but the conditions are created, right? And it's part of the escalation. And you have to understand, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, Zelensky's decision has led to the war. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is an attempt by the government of Ukraine to, or by the president to, yes, deal with political opposition. Yes, more importantly, assert certain forms of political sovereignty over internal decisions and geopolitical direction of the country has led to a reaction from the Kremlin. And that reaction maybe could have gone in a different direction if, I don't know what needed to have happened, but it led to war. And this is, happily for me, I mean, it's ultimately a non-verifiable account. We do not know how the decisions were taken in the Kremlin. And there are some accounts that have been published, and it's almost like a kind of a myth that gets, so you mentioned that it's talked a lot about, and it's, you know, it circulates. Simon Schuster has written about it in Zelensky's biography. It's there on Verstka Media, in Ilya Zhigulov's article. But we do not have credible accounts from within the Russian presidency to confirm that indeed that was the straw that broke camel's back. But I think the account stands on sheer logic.
Yes, thank you, Taras. I think that's a great point to end our conversation into.
Absolutely.
It was a fantastic discussion. And thank you again, Taras.
Thank you, Misha. Thank you, everyone, for the question.
Slavic Connection is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this program represent the views of the hosts and the guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit us online at slavxradio.com. Thank you.
The Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies condemns the Russian Federation's military invasion of Ukraine. We stand in support of the people of Ukraine who are fighting for their lives and sovereignty in the face of the unjustified invasion by Russian military forces.